second half of Parshas Emor deals with the holiday cycle in the Jewish calendar. The beginning, Chodesh Elochem Rosh Chodashim, the beginning deals actually with the part of the year in which we currently are, Sfira, the period we call Sfira, in between the Pesach and Shavuos. The Torah begins, Elam Moed Hashem, Mikrai Kodesh, Asher Tikrosim V'Moadam, etc. It says, the first one is Pesach, that's Nisan, we just had that. After Pesach, it says that you count Sfira, Sfartel Lechem Machras HaShabbos, 49, 50 days of Sfira. Then you have Shavuos. The focus here is on the Karbanos. It mentions that on Pesach you eat matzah and so on. Now, when the Torah explains Sfira, Sfira is the thing that connects, Sfira Ha'omer is the thing that connects Pesach to Shavuos. It actually connects the carbon that you bring on Pesach with the carbon that you bring on Shavuos. The Torah says you eat matzah for 7 days and so on. And then the Torah says that you bring a carbon on the second day of Pesach, Mimachras HaShabbos, you bring a carbon called the Havesim Es Omer Reishis Ktzirich Melakoin. You bring a carbon known as the carbon ha'omer. Omer is actually a very prosaic word. It's kind of exotic to us, but omer is simply a volume measurement. Rashi tells you, Asiris ha'efa, it's a tenth of an efa, a larger volume measurement. It would be like calling it the carbon of the quart or the carbon of the gallon, so to speak. The carbon of the specified quantity of barley that went into this carbon. You bring the carbon ha'omer. This was done Mimachras HaShabbos. That, of course, was the subject of a famous debate between the Sadducees and the Pharisees. That our tradition tells us, Tarash Bal Peh, Machras HaShabbos means the second day of Pesach, Shabbos means Pesach, or Yom Tov. They maintain that it meant the literally Sunday, the day after Shabbos. Classic fight they had. But anyway, so we bring the Omer on the second day of Pesach. After the Omer was accompanied by animal sacrifices too. And then the Torah says, from that, Machras HaShabbos, Miyom HaViyachem is Omer HaTnufa. We call it Sfiras HaOmer because the count begins from the offering of the Omer carbon. You count 7 weeks, 7 times 7, 49, the 50th day. Ad Mimachras HaShabbos, HaShviyas, Tisbru Chamishim Yom, count 49 days or 50 days, and then on the 50th day, you bring Mincha Chadasha, that's the carbon of the Shdei Lechem, also accompanied by animal sacrifices. This was brought from wheat, not barley. And you celebrate the holiday of Shavuos, which doesn't actually have any observances like matzah or anything else on it, the Karbanos, and so on. That pretty much describes the part of the year that we're in. Now, the Torah has one pasuk. When the Torah talks about the offering of the Omer, the Torah writes, "V'lechem v'koli v'charmel lo sochlu ad etzma yom hazeh." You cannot eat lechem, bread, also koli and karmel. Difficult word to translate. Well, koli is not too hard. Koli means roasted kernels of wheat. Karmel, Chazal say it means rach and mole, soft and full. Art Scroll translates it as bread or roasted kernels or plump kernels. You can't eat them ad etzma yom hazeh until the day of the offering of the Omer, the second day of Pesach. Ad haviyachem it's karban alokechem, until you bring the carbon of the Omer. That is chukas el nadarasechem, b'chal mosh vasechem. That is an, as Art Scroll translates, an eternal decree for your generations and all your dwelling places. This, of course, is the prohibition of chadash. Chadash and Yashan are the two complementary terms. They are inverses. Chadash meaning new, Yashan meaning old. Chadash meaning new grain, Yashan meaning old grain. This is the source of the prohibition of Chadash. In contemporary parlance, I hear it more often than not referred to as Yashan. In classic literature, I think you find the term Chadash more often. I'm not sure if there's anything of sociological significance about that. But this is the source for the prohibition of the consumption of Chadash. It's not actually, not even just one prohibition, actually, according to the Rambam and the Chinuch and some of the counters of the mitzvahs, these are actually no fewer than three of the Tariag mitzvahs, one for Lechem, one for Koli, one for Karmel. We're not going to get down too technically into what exactly Koli and Karmel are and how they're different from Lechem. For our purposes, we will simply take it as given that the prohibitions of Chadash apply, the prohibition of Chadash applies to any product containing grain, baked, whatever it is, any product containing grain is subject to the laws of Chadash. Grain is defined, as it often is in halakhic literature, as the chameshes minei dagon, the five species of grain, which are chita, seora, kusmin, shifon, shibol, shuol, commonly translated as wheat, barley, spelt, oats, and rye. The scholarly community, Professor Felix, the Tzmeach v'Chayv Mishnah, and others, Mikra and Mishnah, Others have argued that's not an accurate translation. It's anachronistic to talk about spelt and oats and rye. He has them as other types of wheat and barley. There's some discussion in the poskim, whether lechumra or lekula, we should go with his opinions. But whatever they are, the two big ones for most of us are wheat and barley, to some extent oats also, Cheerios and so on, granola. So the prohibition of chadash applies to any food that has any of the five grains in it. Now, chadash, along, I guess, with gebruch, along with certain types of glatt and chalav Yisrael, are probably the three or four big kashrus controversies that survive today, that different kashrus agencies, different communities, different people have different customs about. These are all disputes that go back hundreds, you know, many hundreds of years. In the case of chadash, that's what we're going to explore today, and explore the antecedents of chadash. What exactly is the issue? It's a pretty straightforward biblical verse. What is the controversy about chadash? Why are some people stringent? Why are some people not stringent? The dominant practice, of course, is to be lenient. As far as I know, certainly in Chutz La'aretz, we'll discuss the distinctions between Eretz Yisrael and Chutz La'aretz. That's one of the key points of difference there. But certainly in Chutz La'aretz, the pretty standard practice is to be lenient. As far as I know, all the major kashrus agencies certify as kosher food that is not necessarily yashan. Some of them offer an optional yashan certification, but there is no major certification that will withhold kashrus certification if it is not yashan. So try to understand, what are the parameters of the prohibition of chadash? Why are some people stringent? Why are most people lenient? That will be what we will explore today. Now, most people probably have at least some familiarity with chadash. At the very least, it's a chumrah that you have to take into account when you have guests or family. Everyone knows someone who's stringent about it. Some of you may know more about it. So we'll just do a brief survey. There's actually a vast literature written on the topic going back to the medieval period and down to contemporary times. We're not going to get too deeply into the contemporary technicalities of all the details of the American farm-to-table process and exactly all the contemporary details. We'll focus mostly on the major halakhic questions that have arisen over the centuries and see what the major discussion is all about with regard to chadash. So first, just to review some of the basic rules, as we've said, the prohibition of chadash applies to any of the five species of grain, however you define those five species. Today, the most common problem is probably wheat. Bagels, bread, cake, cookies, crackers, and so on is probably wheat. As we'll see from the literature, much of the controversy historically seems to have revolved around barley for various reasons, possibly because the question of chadash, as we'll discuss, has a lot to do with the growing cycle, when the grain in question is planted, when it takes root, when it's harvested, when it gets to market. So for historical reasons, it seems that barley was discussed even more than wheat, although other grains come up too. But for us, the three big ones are probably going to be, as I said, wheat, barley, and oats, with wheat, as I said, being relevant to all the bread and cracker type stuff, barley, various products, oats, and so on. It applies to anything. Now, in the time of the Beis HaMikdash, chadash was prohibited until the Karban Omer was brought on the second day of Pesach. In the absence of the Beis HaMikdash, the halacha is largely the same. It basically, we don't have an Omer, but the chadash is prohibited insofar as it is prohibited. It's prohibited until the second day of Pesach, or in Chutz La'aretz, as we'll see, the third day of Pesach, because Sfeika D'Yoma, we treat the second day of Pesach as the first, L'chumra, so the third day of Pesach. There is a dispute in the Talmud about whether it is the beginning of the second or third day for us, or the end of it. Either way, it's largely a moot point. There is very little in the way of grain products that we eat on Pesach outside of matzah. And the matzah generally is going to be yashan. If you're eating it on the first day of Pesach, you're not going to have separate matzah for the second day. So there's a lot of technical literature about it, but practically speaking, there isn't that much significance as to whether it's the beginning of the second day, the end of the second day, the third day. Basically, until the second or third day of Pesach, the prohibition of chadash is intact. After that, all the grain that already exists becomes permitted. Any grain that grows, that takes root after that point, becomes aser, starts out in a state of iser, and needs next Pesach to be matirit, to allow it to be consumed. Now, the Now, the key question, and this is, again, we're not going to get too deeply into the technical aspects, is the key question always is, there is a production, there is a side, there is a process from when a seed is planted till it grows, till it's harvested, till it's processed, threshed, winnowed, ground, made into flour, made into doughs, made into consumer product, shipped, distributed, makes it into supermarkets, makes it into your table. Typically, this is going to be a few months. So right now, actually, is the safe zone, so to speak, for Chadash. It is basically unheard of for any actual product that you're going to see to be Chadash now. I don't know how fast it takes wheat or barley to grow, but certainly with the supply chains that we have today, or even the ones historically, there is no grain that is going to be planted just 3 weeks ago that's already going to mature, be harvested, ground, and everything, and made into cookies, and make it to your table. So this is actually the safe zone of Chadash. Takes a few months, but before, certainly the current situations in the United States, it takes a few months before grain that's planted after Pesach can reach its maturity, go through all those processes, make it to the consumer. Practically speaking, it's usually around August or September where Chadash products begin to be available in the market. That's when the concern starts, and from that time until Pesach, whatever Pesach is, that's when you have the problematic period. And then again, once Pesach hits, everything that already exists becomes mutter. Then you have again a grace period of another few months before the next year's products start making it to the market. So that's basically the prohibition of Chadash. And what we want to discuss today is what are the halachic arguments for or against. Pasuk seems pretty clear. Again, why? Now, historically, even before we get into the halacha, historically, Jews, particularly Ashkenazim, Russia, Poland, Eastern Europe, much of Ashkenazic Jewry was not meticulous about Chadash. This goes back to, as we'll see, the medieval period, the time of the German Rishonim. This was true in the 16th century, in the 17th century. This was true in the 18th and 19th century, and it is, of course, true today. Now, the Sephardic tradition has a somewhat different approach. The Sephardic tradition is considerably more stringent, that both in terms of the historical information that we have about what communities did. Almost all the discussion we're going to have today is in the Ashkenazi community. The Sephardim were more stringent, and even among the Ashkenazim, once you get to the 18th and 19th century, we find a little bit of a divergence between Hasidim and Litvish Jewry. The Hasidim were generally more lenient, Litvish less so. We'll discuss possibly some reasons for that soon. And again, going down to contemporary times, Sephardim still today are often more stringent than Ashkenazim. Not all Sephardim are stringent, particularly where it's difficult, but Sephardim in general are more stringent, Ashkenazim less so. Within the Ashkenazic community, Chadash has had a sort of renaissance in the last few decades. Ashkenazim have become much more stringent. Again, we do find something of a cleavage here between the Hasidic and, I guess, the yeshivish communities. For lack of a better term, the yeshiva and non-Hasidic communities have been much quicker to adapt the stringencies about Chadash than the Hasidic communities, and we'll discuss again some of the historical reasons for that. I just want to open with a rather interesting tshuva of the Chasam Sofer. He's quoting his legendary teacher, Rabbi Nosson Adler. Didn't write that much. We have his teaching through his student, Chasam Sofer, who revered him. He was a brilliant mind, creative, a Kabbalist, just an innovative thinker, a very pious individual. So the Chasam Sofer has a tshuva where he's discussing the propriety of calling up people for aliyahs, people who are not that religious, who violate certain mitzvahs. And they're discussing in general whether they should, these people, what if they're only chumras, if they're not so makbid on chumras, you know, when is it appropriate to give somebody an aliyah or not? We're not going to get into the details of that conversation. But in the course of his analysis, the Chasam Sofer, number 9 here, the last citation on the page, he says that the custom of his Rebbe, Rabbi Nosson Adler, was that on Yom Tov of Sukkos, Parshas Emor, this section of the Parsha is read at least twice a year. Once is Parshas Emor, this coming Shabbos. The other time it is the laning of Sukkos, the Yom Tovim. We read it on the second day of Sukkos. So Rabbi Nosson Adler said, with regard to the laning of the second day of Sukkos, he would not give, on the Yom Tov of Sukkos, he would not give a Levi, the Aliyah of Levi, to someone who ate Chadash, someone who, as most of us do, are not stringent about Chadash. Because at that time, Sukkos time, Chadash products are already hitting the market. As we noted, it tends to be around the fall where Chadash products are making it to the market. And it's not the Yetha Omer, it's not Pesach yet. And the Levi, he says, he's going to read on the Yontif of Sukkot, he's going to read V'lechem, V'koli, V'charmel, L'Soklu, V'etzem HaYom HaZeh. He's going to read the pasuk about how it's prohibited to eat Chadash until Pesach. And this guy, he says, this guy is going to get up to the Torah and make the bracha, and they're going to read this pasuk. And then he's going to go home and drink his beer and his liquor, which is fermented from grain. And he's going to eat his bread, which is Mechumat B'Shimrei Shechar. Not sure exactly what shmarim are here, either the yeast or the preservatives or some kind of active ingredient in the bread came from the beer. Shel rov poskim gam bezman hazeh is an isur daraisa. So Rabbi Nosson Adler said that the Levi should not get this aliyah. Now, incidentally, it's interesting sociologically. He mentions seorim, he mentions barley. Barley was hitting the market. Where is barley consumed? It's consumed as an ingredient in bread, an active ingredient in bread, and it's beer and different types of liquor. If I were to ask most of us what is the food in which we consume barley, I think the answer, I mean, some people are, I'm sure, are passionate beer drinkers, but for those who are not, it's probably cholent. Cholent has barley. I don't know why he didn't mention cholent. Maybe that the Hungarian or Eastern European cholent recipes back then didn't have barley. I don't know. Now again, it seems that wheat was not as much of an issue, either because the wheat crops, based on the agricultural cycles, the wheat crops were different. They got to market later, or they were always chadash. They were always yashin. Certain types of crops are always yashin because they wait long enough by the time they're harvested to bring them to market. For whatever reason, certain types of grains are typically always yashin. Whatever it is, he seems to have been worried primarily about barley, assuming the language in the tshuva is precise, and barley went into alcohol, beer, liquor, and bread, and it was the height of hypocrisy, he felt, to give somebody this aliyah if he was eating chadash. Now, it seems he wasn't really so concerned about the aliyah on Parshas Emor, and the reason for that is because, as the language of the tshuva indicates, the chadash products were not yet at the market. So even though this guy ate chadash a month ago and he will eat chadash in 6 months from now, since right now at this time of the year he's in the safe zone, he's not eating chadash, the hypocrisy is not as manifest. But on Sukkot, where he's going to go home and have his suda and eat chadash, that was more of a blatant hypocrisy that he felt was inappropriate. That is the opinion of Rabbi Nosson Adler.
You don't have chalent on Yom Tov.
Right. Someone actually suggested that to me this morning, that perhaps if it was Yom Tov and it wasn't Shabbos, and perhaps, again, just like he wasn't worried about 6 months from now, maybe he wasn't worried about 2 days from now either. He was only worried about, Tuch de Dibur, within an hour, he's going home and eating his suda. That was the problem, and there was no challenge on Yanta. Perhaps, I don't know. But be that as it may, his position was you cannot give the aliyah to someone who was not meticulous about Chadash. Now, I saw Rav Avadia Yosef, which is where I bumped into this. Rav Avadia Yosef actually suggests that he's not convinced by this. He brings from Rav Chaim Ben Venisti, the Knesset Gdola. He was talking about a person who is lax in arayas, in forbidden sexual relations. So the Knesset Gdola says such a person could be called up for the parsha of arayas. It's entirely appropriate, he says. He'll learn mussar. The Torah says, don't do this and don't do that. Maybe he'll put the fear of God into him and he'll stop doing what he shouldn't be doing. Says Rav Avadia, that can be a counter-argument to Rabbi Nosson Adler and the Chasam Sofer too. A person reads the parsha of Chadash, he'll say, wait a second, the Torah says, V'lechem v'koli v'charma lo sochlu, maybe I should reconsider my habits and my observance. All right. So this obviously is a gateway to discuss the question. So how important is it to eat Chadash? Did they feel, himself and Rabbi Nosson Adler, did they feel that this was absolutely mandatory? Did they feel it was a good chumrah? What level of propriety do they feel Chadash was? That's something we'll explore again as we get into the more technical sources. I will note, I was speaking to a friend of mine recently, or I told him I'm speaking about Chadash, so he told me, if I recall correctly, having heard a share from Rav Avadia, as we said, the Sfaradim are much more strict about this, and in general, in Eretz Yisrael, they're much more strict about this. As we'll see, a number of the reasons that we're going to discuss for leniency do not apply in Eretz Yisrael. So the Rav Avadia was talking about the binding nature of the prohibition of Chadash. So my friend says he heard someone ask him, what about Chutz La'aretz? Is that quite as stringent as Eretz Yisrael? So Rav Avadia says, Chutz La'aretz, mali chazir, mali chadash. Swine's flesh is aser, chadash is aser. Now obviously Rav Avadia was a bit of a showman, aside from being a genius. He was a bit of a showman too, but the point is Rav Avadia felt very strongly that chadash was a binding prohibition. And that's what we'll discuss now. What are the bases for leniency, which again have been adopted throughout the history of Ashkenazic halacha? So we'll discuss maybe a half dozen halachic considerations, which have been proposed by themselves, have been proposed in tandem with each other, in combination. You know, two or three of these things were often posited by the poskim as together being basis for leniency, and one what we call, I guess, a meta halachic consideration. Many poskim acknowledge that there was tremendous shasat chak. The Jews were just desperate. The Jews often were usually not farmers. They were dependent on the non-Jews for their grain supplies. And very often, I guess, there was much less visibility than we have into the supply chain. They didn't know. They couldn't verify. They couldn't source all the grain they were getting. If you would be stringent on Chadash, many poskim, beginning with the medieval and down to relatively recent, a century or two ago, have said that it was a shasat chag gadol. It was very difficult to be stringent, and many poskim have acknowledged, either explicitly or implicitly, that was a major basis for the heter. Now, obviously, you can't violate halacha because it's hard. But the point is, many of the svaras many of the ideas we're going to see were not things that we would paskin like in a straightforward way. They were things that the poskim proposed, acknowledging often explicitly that we're going to rely on certain opinions or certain novel ideas because we are desperate to find some heter. And this, in turn, really serves as the meta-halachic basis for the stringency today. Those who are stringent, their argument basically is, in a very broad way, that most of the leniencies proposed were because it was so difficult to do otherwise. Today in the United States, it is vastly easier than it used to be. We have more money, we have more resources, we have more information, we have the internet, we have more visibility into the supply chain, more transparency, more options, more opportunities. You know, for so many reasons, it is so... Now, I'm not saying it's trivial, but the point is, it is orders of magnitude easier today to find out what you're getting and to source your food in such a way that avoids chadash. So that's kind of the, broadly speaking, that's the reason for the renaissance that chadash has had in the last few decades. But without further ado, let's go and see what some of the arguments have been historically for being lenient about chadash. So the most prominent early source is probably the Arzarua, Rabbi Yitzchak Arzarua, Rabbi Yitzchak of Vienna, a leading Austrian Ashkenazic authority. He discusses the question in his Sefer Arzarua. He begins by proclaiming, Chadash Asur Minat Torah B'chol Makom. Chadash is biblically prohibited everywhere, even in Chutz Laaretz. Incidentally, just a digression on the topic, said no further ado, but just one little ado. The phrase Chadash Asur Minat Torah, Chadash is biblically prohibited, has taken on a life of its own. It achieved great prominence in the 19th century battles against reform. The Chasam Sofer, who was a leading fighter against the incursions of reform, the Chasam Sofer, and then later his students and his followers, who were even more vehement than he was, the Chasam Sofer was very much opposed, deeply suspicious of any innovation, any tampering with time-honored ritual, even something which, on its face, objectively, might not be so bad. Everything was suspect of being a wedge issue, the nose of the camel, of being a basis for importing foreign traditions into Judaism. The Chasam Sofer coined a kind of aphorism, a kind of play on words, Chadash Asur Minat Torah. Anything new is prohibited Minat Torah. The original use of the phrase was this one in the Arzarua, that Chadash, meaning new grain, is biblically prohibited. He transformed it into a kind of socio-religious doctrine that anything new is by default forbidden. But the Arzarua here is using the phrase in the initial literal sense of the word. The starting point is, Chadash is Asur Minat Torah B'chol Makom. If so, says the Arzarua, Tema, how can this be? Says, if Chadash applies in Chutz Laaretz, it applies even to grain of non-Jews. So he says, how can we buy Tvua from the non-Jews? What happened to Chadash? We don't know for sure it's Chadash. We don't know for sure it's not. It might be. We know there's plenty of Chadash floating around. We have no visibility, no transparency of the supply chain, so everything should be Asur. It's a Safek Daraisa. He goes on. He says, how are we allowed to eat it? It should be a Sveka Daraisa. The end of the first paragraph, he says, everything should be Asur. He says, we know for a fact they do plant after Pesach. There is some, we know enough about the agricultural cycle to know there is grain that is planted after Pesach. As we said before, anything that's planted within a month or two before, a few months before Pesach, it's fine. It's not going to get to the consumer for a few months, so it's going to be okay. But the problem is anything planted after Pesach can be a problem. Just for precision's sake, the key question is what we call hashrasha. Hashrasha means taking root. It doesn't depend on when you physically put the seed in the ground. The key factor in chadash is when the grain takes root, which halacha defines formally by a certain amount of days after the putting the seed in. If the hashrasha, if that point in time occurs before Pesach, even if it's still growing and still needs to develop, that grain is going to be mutter when it eventually makes its way to your table. If that point called hashrasha, taking root, has not taken place before Pesach, then you need next Pesach to do it, and you have to wait. So the problem is, we know they do plant grain after Pesach. That grain begins to hit the market at some point before the next Pesach. So much of the grain that's floating around in the market for much of the year is going to be chadash. It's a suffix, we don't know for sure, but suffix deraisa l'chumra, insofar as the prohibition is biblical, we seem to have a very serious problem. So how can we do it? So we're not going to get into the technical details of his resolution. Basically, most of the discussion, the early discussion, involves extremely technical readings of various conflicting Talmudic passages, trying to tease out which ones are normative, which ones do we follow. We'll just jump to his conclusion. His conclusion is, in spite of the way he started by saying Chadash Asmer Tar B'chal Makom, he actually retreats from that position. He says, no, actually, because he acknowledges the Gemara brings conflicting opinions about whether Chadash applies Minat Torah B'chal Makom or not. There are opinions that Chadash, on a biblical level, does not apply in Chutz Lartz. It may still apply on a rabbinic level, but on a biblical level, it does not apply in Chutz Lartz. It's a Machlokes HaPoskim, he says. And therefore, since it is a tremendous Shas Hadchak, he repeats the idea of Shas Hadchak more than once. He says, Ika Shas Hadchak. He says, we can't get by. The second to last line of the second big paragraph, Ika Shas Hadchak, lo efshir lan shlo liknas tvu of alechem. We have to buy grain. We have to buy bread from the non-Jews. We don't have our own farms. We don't have our own production. So he says, therefore, there's a rule in halacha. We can rely on even a contested opinion, even a minority opinion maybe, certainly when there are major opinions on both sides. B'shas Hadchak, we have the right to follow the minority opinion. Therefore, we can adopt the opinion that it is only Midrabanan. Midrabanan is still Aser. But once it's Midrabanan, then instead of saying Safek D'Oraisa L'Chumra, we can say Safek D'Oraisa L'Kula. Safek D'Rabanan L'Kula, thank you. And that's what we're making on. So that's his idea. His idea is A, it's a Shas Hadchak. B, there are different opinions about whether Chadash is Aser in Chutz Laretz, Minat Torah, or Midrabanan. C, it's generally a suffix, so misuffix, so because of Shas Hadchak, we can rely on the opinions that it's only Midrabanan. Once it's Midrabanan, we can rely on the fact that it's a suffix, and we can be lenient. And of course, he concludes that being the basis for the heter, insofar as it's not a suffix, if Jews actually have farms, and they can tell you exactly when their tefuah was planted and harvested and everything, osam Yisraelim who have sados and chutzlarts, and they plant and they grow their stuff after Pesach, that's absolutely Aser, he says, no heter whatsoever. Such grain will be Aser, and certainly Jews in Eretz Yisrael, according to him, certainly would have to be Machmer, and obviously the grain grown in Eretz Yisrael, which I imagine is largely grown by Jews, except maybe during Shemitah where they sell the land, but in general where most of the farming is done by Jews, I assume, the Narzaru would tell you, you're out of luck, you have to treat such food, such grain, as Chadash. So this was the opinion of the Arzaruah. The Shulchan Aruch, writing several hundred years later, does not accept any such heter. The Shulchan Aruch takes it as a matter of course that Chadash is Aser in Chutz Laretz. Chadash is Aser even with the grain, even with respect to the grain of non-Jews. He brings no heter whatsoever. Shulchan Aruch discusses the question actually twice, once in Arachayim, in the Hilchos Shavuos, in the end of Hilchos Pesach, like with the way the Torah does, once again in Yerideya, discussing the whole, all the different prohibitions that apply to food, challah and arla and shmita and so on, brings it again. In both places, the Shulchan Aruch, Maran, the Mechaber, in both places, the Shulchan Aruch brings no heter whatsoever. He says, Aser lechol chadash, af bizman hazeh, lechem kalei v'karmel until Pesach, chutz laretz, Eretz Yisrael. In Yerideya, he explicates further, chamesh aminim, until Eretz Yisrael Chutz Laretz, Ha'idni says everything's Aser, Isser Chadash Noeg, Bein Ba'aretz, Bein B'Chutz Laretz, Bein B'Shal Yisrael, Bein B'Shal Goyim. The Arzaruah didn't make much of an impression on him, he discounts it, and he flat out says that Chadash is Aser. As I said, the Sfaradim don't really know anything about Haterim. I mean, the Beis knew the Arzaruah, but the Sfaradim don't acknowledge any real Haterim. The early Sfaradim, certainly in the Mechaber, flat out rules that it is prohibited. Now, even the Ramah, the basis for Ashkenazic custom, does not really bring the Arzah Ruah, does not bring the idea that we can rely on leniencies, Drabanan, Sav Drabanan. He doesn't bring any of that. What he does bring is a different heter, also based on Safek. He brings a heter which would apply even if Chadash is Daraisa. Now, normally we know if the Isser is Daraisa, the normal rule that would apply would be Safek Daraisa L'chumra. But he says it's actually a Sfek Sfeika or a Rov. He constructs a Sfek Sfeika, which is a dual Safek, a pair of Sfekas. This is a very controversial matter. Head accounts fakers, whether the Sfek Sfeika he makes is maybe it was last year's grain, even if it's this year, maybe it was pre-Pesach grain. Everyone challenges him, Rabbi Kiva Eger, that's really one Safek. There's one question. Halacha cares about one thing. Did you make the cutoff or not? Is it before Pesach or after Pesach? Hard to understand why he calls that two Sfekas. Gets into some very, very, very profound, very murky waters of Sfek Sfeika. We're not going to well beyond the scope of our talk. But the point is, the Ramah does not bring any heterim of chutzlar, does not bring any heterim of tvua shel non-Jews. All he brings is some kind of argument of Sfek Sfeika, which is problematic. That's the only heter the Ramah brings. He brings one other sort of heter, not really a heter. The Ramah, in the end of number two, the Ramah says that even if someone, you know, wants to be more machmer and doesn't want to rely on these types of arguments, he says, that's fine, he can be machmer for himself. Ein laharos la'cherim. He should not issue public rulings that chadash is prohibited. B'makom sherov shdiyasen v'achilasen minim elu, in a place where most of the consumption is from these types of products, chadash. Why? Mutav shiyushogin v'liyum ezidim. People are not going to listen. Sometimes discretion is the better part of valor. We just don't say anything. This obviously is not much of a heter. This is simply an idea that sometimes if you talk, you make things worse, and you have to know when to hold them, so to speak. This is obviously not a heter. This is just, you know, people are not going to listen. So that this is the only other thing the Ramah says. Other than that, he has no fundamental, you know, real satisfying heter aside from this idea of Sfek Sfeika and Rov. So that's really the third type of argument we have. Well, so far we've discussed really two. Besides Shas Adchak, we've said Chadash in Chutz Laretz, and the idea of Sfeikas and Sfek Sfeikas, possibly as Zar Zeruah does, combined, it's only Drabanan and Sfeikas, or as Rama does, enough Sfeikas can be mastered by themselves. Those are two of the big heter. The third heter is known as the heter of the Bach. The Bach, Rav Yoel Sirkis, another Ashkenazic authority, writing about the turn of the 17th century, I suppose, he also acknowledges that, he starts by saying, Haminag Pashut B'Malchuseinu. In our countries, he says, the widespread custom is to be lenient in Chadash, not just the masses, he says, even the Gedolei Torah. Gedolei HaTorah Shehayu Lefaneinu, Rav Shachna, one of the great figures before the generation of the Ramah, Rav Shlomo Luria, the Marshal, Talmideim, they would not prohibit products based on Chadash. Except, he says, Miktas Chasidim, there were always some, this is before actual Chasidus, he means pious individuals, there were always some who were more stringent, he says. Certain people were machmer, but the general custom of the Hechsherim, so to speak, of the dominant practice was not to be stringent. So he wonders, he wonders why they were so lenient. So I've cut most of his analysis, again, very technical, involving various Talmudic passages. His heter is a third heter, or fourth, depending how you're counting, similar to the Arzah Ruah, that in Chutz Laretz it's more lenient. But instead of relying on Chutz Laretz, he says he has a different heter, that Tvua of non-Jews is a basis for leniency, perhaps even in Eretz Yisrael. Or even if you're Machmer in Chutz Laretz in general, if it belongs to a non-Jew, that's a heter. And again, we're not going to get into why, what the Talmudic source for this is. That's his heter. So there are, you know, again, there are four possibilities. Tvua of a Jew in Eretz Yisrael, Tvua of a non-Jew in Chutz Laretz, Tvua of a non-Jew in Eretz Yisrael, Tvua of a Jew in Chutz Laretz. So the Arzah Ruah is focusing on Tvuas Chutz Laretz, he's focusing on Tvua of a non-Jew. Again, similar heter, both these heterim would help us largely in the United States, where most of the farming is not done by Jews. Both of them will not help very much in Eretz Yisrael. Eretz Yisrael, it's a matter of course, I think they are Machmer on Chadash, because these two big heterim have a lot of overlap, and they both help for much of Chutz Laretz, they both don't help for much of Eretz Yisrael. The Bach concludes, again, that this is a solid basis for leniency, he feels. Again, he does acknowledge that it was Shas Adchak, but he says, because the minhag is so well established, nobody should rule in public against the lenient tradition. Again, Misha Rotzel Ha'achmer La'atzom, Bidit Chasidus, who shouldn't rule publicly otherwise, he says. And only someone who is machmer in other areas, someone who's a pious individual in general. Not every would-be elitist should be doing this, he says. He fails as a pretty solid heter. Now, there's a remarkable tshuva of the Avinezer. Avinezer, Rabbi Avram of Sachachov, writing about several hundred years later, the turn of the 20th century, he mentions this Bach, and he says that the Bach is the basis for what he calls the Hasidic custom. He says, Hasidic Poland, the Hasidim of Poland, are not strict about Chadash, and it's based on this Bach. He says the Rebbe of Lublin, I'm not sure if that's the Choser or somebody else, the Rebbe of Lublin, he says, used to serve Chadash, used to serve a certain product based on Chadash, and he explained why. He explained that his ancestor, his Zikno, his grandfather, great-grandfather, the Bach, permitted Chadash, the Bach we just talked about, and therefore that's his tradition, and therefore he serves Chadash, and the Hasidim of Poland, following their Rebbe, serve Chadash. This Avinezer is sometimes cited as the basis for the Hasidic or the widespread tradition to be lenient. If you read Avinezer in context, it tells a somewhat different story. It's not wrong, but it tells a somewhat different story. The Avinezer's question actually had nothing to do with Chadash. The original question he was dealing with had to do with Esrogim. The question had to do with Esrogim of Corfu, the Greek Isle of Corfu. Esrogim of Corfu were a centuries-old controversy, going back again to the time of the Bach or earlier. The question was whether they were Murkav, whether they were grafted of Esrogim and lemons, a major problem in Esrogim always. And the Bach was actually lenient. The Bach felt they were okay. Many other poskim disagreed and felt you should not use an Esrog of Corfu. Now, Avinezer says that the Hasidim may want to follow the Rebbe of Lublin, who used to be a big fan of Esrogim of Corfu. So the Avinezer says, he starts by saying, well, if the Rebbe used them, then he must have known, Baruch HaKodesh, that these were honest to goodness kosher Esrogim, and that's great. You know, he was a great man, we can rely on him. Then he walks that back and says, not so fast. He says, when the Rebbe relied on Esrogim of Corfu, we don't know that it was because of any Ruach HaKodesh. Maybe once again it was because his great-grandfather, the Bach, was known to have a lenient position, and no one's accusing the Bach of having Ruach HaKodesh. The Bach was simply a Talmudist. The Bach learned the Gemara. The Bach analyzed the sugya and came to this conclusion. Says Avinezer, if that's all it is, a tradition going back to the Bach, then it's not normative because many disagreed with the Bach. So the same way, he says, we find that the Rebbe of Lublin followed the Bach on Chadash, so maybe he followed the Bach on this question too. And at least with regard to this question, he says his position is not normative because many people disagreed. So he isn't actually bringing the traditions of the Bach as being dispositive for Klal Yisrael. He's saying the Rebbe of Lublin, who was a descendant of the Bach, was very taken with his rulings and accepted them for himself and for his Hasidim. Avinezer is somewhat equivocal. You know, it's not his primary point to discuss Chadash, but he's saying that at least for the Rebbe of Lublin, this was his tradition to follow his great ancestor, the Bach, and to be lenient on both these questions. Hardly clear that this should be the basis for a general heter of Chadash for anyone. Now, the truth is, again, one of the most important of Hasidic works, particularly for Chabad, actually is somewhat machmer. The Shulchan Aruch HaRav, the Rosh Nir Zalman of Liadi, the founder of Chabad Hasidus, he goes through all the various heterim, the ones we've quoted, one or two other ones. He actually is not so happy about these heterim. The Shulchan Aruch HaRav says that the number seven, the Graz, Rav Zalman, he also acknowledges the minhag to be lenient. He brings the various different proposals of the Mekilim. He acknowledges that they aren't all that satisfactory. Again, we have a strong minhag to be lenient, so he doesn't demand an overturning of the minhag, but he says his conclusion is, Kol Bal Nefesh, as earlier and both earlier poskim to him and later poskim to him have both said, Kol Bal Nefesh, Lo Yismach Al Matir Malalu. Unlike the Bach, who says only someone who's meforsim to be a specially pious individual, the Shulchan Aruch HaRav is somewhat broader than that. He says any Bal Nefesh, anyone who's really moved to do the right thing, should not rely on the Matirim. He should be machmer for himself to the extent that he can, like the Askama of Rov Rishonim and Achronim, that Chadash applies Min HaTorah, Af B'Chutflar, Tu B'Chal Makom, Af B'Shal Nachrim, Ki Chein Iker. I don't actually know what contemporary Chabad practice is, but the Shulchan Aruch HaRav is, he doesn't demand that the minhag be overturned, but he says that clearly the right thing to do is to be stringent in Chadash. So again, in spite of the fact that we have numerous different testimonies that the Hasidic communities in Europe and till this day were lenient, it's not the case that the Hasidic poskim were also lenient. They bring the Baal Shem Tov, apparently there are stories that he was very enthusiastic about eating Chadash, but the major Hasidic poskim were far from unequivocal about it being a bona fide heter. Now the Gaon. The Baal HaTosfos do discuss it. The parts of the Achronim that I've skipped for brevity and to avoid complications cite numerous comments of the Rishonim. When people like the Shulchan Aruch Harav and other later poskim say that most Rishonim say it's Usser, the Chassam Sofer we began with also, the Chassam Sofer's language in number 9 is in the name of Rassan Adler that Rov poskim say Bizmanet Eretz Daraisa. I think that includes most of the Baal HaTosfos. The Baal HaTosfos were split. You know, many of them weighed in on it. There were some in the Arzeruah's camp who were lenient. But by and large, I think even among the Ashkenazic Rishonim, there were by no means a consensus. I think the majority was still, I didn't really do a survey of all the opinions, but I think even among the Ashkenazic Rishonim, I think there was still at least serious opinions on both sides, if not a majority toward Usser, toward the stringent view. The Gaon of Vilna, the Gra, was also very strict, probably even stricter than the Shulchan Aruch Harav. The Gaon brings some of the earlier Achronim who were lenient. He says the Bach, he said, Kvar hiku al kadkado, everyone beat the Bach over the head. Shugaga yatim itakas yado, it's just an error. He says the Bach is completely wrong. Ber Hagolo, who brought part of the Bach and argued for leniency, would have done better just remaining silent, he says. The other Eterim are not very good either. They're Dachuk. The Gaon was very strict, and that's, I think, again, one of the bases for the yeshiva world tendency toward stringency, I think, here is that the Gaon, who's one of the leading lights for the yeshiva world, was not happy about the heterim. And again, that's kind of, little I understand of it, that's kind of the typical for the Gaon. The Gaon was very much back to the books. He acknowledged Minhag maybe, but the Gaon wanted a solid Talmudic source. Here, all the poskim who are Mekil, kind of the Alpha and Omega, is the combination of Minhag, it's a well-entrenched custom, and desperation, that it was Shasat Chach. So they looked for heterim they wouldn't otherwise have found. The Gaon was not very happy with the various heterim. Now the Magen Avraham, another early Achron, another heter, he also has a kind of combination of all these various things we've been discussing. He also mentions the idea, similar to the Arzeruah, that Chadash may not apply in Chutz La'aretz. But as we said, it still might be Drabanan. So the Arzeruah therefore said, even if it's Drabanan, it's still Usser. So you have to have a suffix or some kind of suffix to be Maturit. Magen Avraham says, if it's Drabanan, we have another angle of Kula, that some poskim say that something that was only Midrabanan, they didn't prohibit it all across the world. When the agricultural related mitzvahs that Chazal prohibited were only in certain countries that were near Eretz Yisrael. The Near East, the Middle East, maybe Syria, Jordan, these types of countries. Doesn't apply in Western Europe and Eastern Europe, certainly not in the New World. There is such an opinion of the Rishonim. It's something of a minority opinion. The Gaon again rejects this Magen Avraham and says Dvarav D'chukim Ma'od. It's not mashma this way. So again, the Magen Avraham is coming up with another heter, also a combination of the fact that it's not Daraisa. Once it's Drabanan, we can be flexible. We can make arguments for where they made rabbinic ordinances and where not. But again, it's far from a slam dunk. Magen Avraham himself acknowledges that he's doing it liyashiv min ha'olam. Aval bal nefesh, again, yachmer b'mashef shelo lizar. So a person should try to be machmer. These heterim are given to justify the custom, but these are not really what we would say if we were looking at it completely objectively. The Gaon himself acknowledges that and says, Magen Avraham himself said he wasn't giving his kind of unbiased opinion. He was just looking for a yeshu for the minhag of the olam. That's the kind of thing that cuts both ways. On the one hand, if you acknowledge that the svara wasn't your first choice and you're only proposing it liyashiv minhag ha'olam, that means it's not a great svara. On the other hand, minhag carries a tremendous weight in halacha, so hard to know what to do with that, but the Gaon was not so impressed. The Mishnah Berurah also pretty much brings the language of the Shulchan Aruch Harav and the Magen Avraham, that there are heterim and the minhag is to be lenient, but that a person, a bal nefesh, should try to be machmer where possible. Now, not trying to establish what the halacha should or shouldn't be today. If you speak to contemporary poskim in the U.S., you'll get all kinds of opinions about whether you should or shouldn't be machmer, whether it's a good idea, don't bother. I saw an article by Rabbi Chaim Howard Jachter, where he says that he heard from Rav Soloveitchik that he personally was not strict about Chadash, and that Rav Moshe Feinstein, he heard from a student of Rav Moshe, that the yeshiva and MTJ was not strict about, or Moshe himself was not strict, he would eat the yeshiva's food. And again, every major kashrus agency certifies food that is not That is not yashan. Some of them will also certify food as being yashan when they know that it is. And you know, as usual, you can ask your local rabbi for what he thinks the recommended practice is. As I've said, the main reason for stringency is that most of the poskim acknowledge, many of them acknowledge that the basis for leniency was the difficulty, and that difficulty doesn't apply as much today. Just returning to the Chasam Sofer, who says, or Nathan Adler, who said that you should not give the aliyah to someone who eats chadash. So the question is, how stringency were they taking the issue of chadash? So the Chasam Sofer adds one other example of this type of principle. He says, someone who is not particular about Shemitah's Ksafim, the idea that debts are canceled on Shemitah, shouldn't be given the aliyah to the parsha, during the year of Shemitah, the parsha of Lo Yigas Esriyehu, of implementing the law of Shemitah. And he says, someone who doesn't write a prosbul, both before and after Shemitah, shouldn't get the parsha. Some say he actually, I don't know what the custom in shul, did the shul do prosbuls here? So most shuls, I think, do prosbuls the end of Shemitah, which is the norm of halacha. There is a custom some poskim have recommend to write a prosbul in the end of the previous year too. A couple of reasons for that, either because some poskim say Shemitah has some effect in the beginning of Shemitah. Some people say that this has to do with the debate about what year Shemitah is. But there is such a custom. The Chasam Sofer says that if people don't write prosbuls on both years, they shouldn't get the aliyah. That's certainly a chumrah. Some say the Chasam Sofer himself and other tshuvas implies that he didn't actually advocate writing an early prosbul. He says himself that he watched Rav Nosson Adler, I kamat lo zaza yadi miyado, I hung around him, I stuck to him like glue, and I know he didn't write such a prosbul. Since Eliezer, I think, proposes that Chasam Sofer really means here either or, if you didn't write at least one prosbul either before or afterward. But whatever it is, the Chasam Sofer says, if you don't write a prosbul, you shouldn't get the, if you ignore Shemitah totally, obviously if you're going to waive your debts, that's great, call a kavod to you. But he means if you don't write a prosbul and you ignore Shemitah and you collect your debts, you shouldn't be given this aliyah. So I have to look up the language again. I think he does make a point of saying Hashdas Nasa Shemitah. And it makes sense that it would be that year. I'm not sure. You can argue that even after that year, you're still in constant violation if you collect the debt. So I'm not sure. Now, you can argue that Shemitah also really, Shemitah actually is a fairly close analogy to Chadash, because Shemitah also there exists, this is a topic that'll take us beyond the scope of our talk, but Shemitah also, there exists an ancient Ashkenazic tradition to ignore Shemitah, not even bother to write prosbuls, going back to the time of the Rush, and recorded in the Shulchan Aruch. Rav Moshe Feinstein actually says, the prosbul we do is a chumra, he says. You should do it, it's a chumra. But the Ikra Din, for Ashkenazim at least, is that we don't necessarily insist on Shemitah. So the Chasam Sofer may have felt the same way about Chadash, that on paper, the argument, both Shemitah and Chadash, is very strong that it should apply. In practice, the custom often was people were not strict about it. But again, Rav Poskim say you should do it. So we have this kind of tension between a minhag lahakel, but a strong, on paper, argument to be machmer. A person really should be machmer. We can't absolutely forbid it. That's enough to say you shouldn't get the aliyah. What exactly Chasam Sofer meant when he says, according to most Poskim, it's daraisa, and there's no heter, whether he actually meant he held you a Russia if he did it, or he just meant, as I said, you're not a Russia, but you're foregoing a chumrah which he felt was recommended, like the Shulchan Aruch Harav, like the Mishnah Berurah. Hard to know. In any event, I should just close by, I've avoided all the technicalities about the actual agricultural cycle. Many of the poskim who are lenient in the U.S. are lenient based on their knowledge of how the cycle works and what products actually make it to market, and based on different kinds of sfeikas. So to actually apply the halacha, you really have to have more information about the current agricultural and food manufacturing cycle. But these are, just from the bird's eye view, these are the major halakhic issues, kind of the history of some of the, most of the main arguments that have come up. These are the arguments, l'chumra and l'kula, and this is pretty much how the later poskim left it, with Baal Nefesh being machmer, was kind of a somewhat consensus view, although again, the Aruch HaShulchan was more lenient. The Aruch HaShulchan said, it's a solid heter, we can b'la mitzchus, it's fine, it's glat, but again, Mishnah Berurah, the Shulchan Aruch HaRav, Magen Avram, all ruled that a Baal Nefesh Yachmer, where possible, a Baal Nefesh should try to be stringent and not consume Chadash products.